Hey guys, Montel here, and welcome to this edition of Let's Be Blunt with Montel, where we dive deep into conversations about cannabis legalization and everything in between. I'm your host, Montel Williams, and today we're getting to the heart of cannabis legalization and what it means for our communities and our country with a very special guest. She's been at the forefront of shaping cannabis policy, breaking barriers, and advocating for equity in the cannabis industry. She's a distinguished cannabis policy practitioner in residence at the Ohio State University Barrett College of Law's Drug Enforcement and Policy Center, and a contributing author to the Thomas Reuters Cannabis Law Desk Book. She also serves as vice chair of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition and an advisor to the Parabola Center for Law and Policy. She was the first person of color in the nation to lead a medical and adult use regulatory program. And from 2017 to 2022, she served as the first executive director of the City of Los Angeles Department of Cannabis Regulation. Please welcome the Director of Drug Markets and Legal Regulation at the Drug Policy Alliance, Kat Packer. Thank you so much, Kat, for being a part of the show today.
Thanks for having me, Montel.
Absolutely. Look, before we dive right in, share a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and what led you to pursue a career in cannabis.
Yeah, so I grew up in Hampton, Virginia, in Williamsburg, Virginia, with my mom, but ended up moving to Ohio to live with my father at the age of 16 in Columbus, Ohio, and stayed in Ohio through high school and college. I ended up attending Ohio State University for undergrad and for my master's degree and for law school. And it was while I was in law school that I had an opportunity to take a marijuana law and policy course. And it was while I was taking this course that I read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, where she says that nothing has contributed more to the systematic mass incarceration of people of color in the United States than the war on drugs. And that particular quote and just learning about the harms of cannabis criminalization, particularly the Black and brown communities, I ended up leaving that class deciding that I wanted to pursue a profession in cannabis law and policy.
And right there, please, will you just illuminate for some of the people that are watching this, give them an understanding of what you learned that blew your mind to make you want to do this? Because, you know, I've been talking about this and preach. I feel like sometimes I'm preaching to the choir. People don't even listen to me. I keep saying, you know, what people have to recognize is that if we go all the way back to 1937 and take a look at when cannabis prohibition began and recognize that it didn't start because of illicit drugs. It started because of what was called the Marijuana Tax Act and was really something that was, you know, basically pursued because you had a guy that by the name of Anslinger, who was the head of the alcohol prohibition movement, lost his job when prohibition with alcohol stopped and needed to find something to do. And he, of course, got funded by William Randolph Hearst, Charles DuPont, to vilify this substance that everybody in America, everybody in the world was using, was one of the things that literally, I think, you know, when people look back at America, they think that cotton or tobacco were two of our biggest crops, but no one really recognizes the fact that cannabis, hemp, was our biggest crop since this country was founded. And now we move forward from 1937 and take a look at something that was vilified. And I've heard numbers as high as 75% of all the cannabis arrests since that date were of people of color. Is that right? Or am I close to right or no?
Montel, you're spot on with the history up until the present day facts and statistics. The reality is that here in the United States, cannabis policy was not guided by science or reason. But largely by fear and misinformation and racism. Harry Anslinger, as you pointed out, he was the director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics after alcohol prohibition had failed. This is the predecessor to today's DEA. And he's on record saying things like, reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men.
Absolutely. It'll make a black man want to step on a white man's shadow. Makes white women want to have sex with black people. And there are other quotes by that same butthead back when he was running alcohol prohibition, where he said that marijuana was a better drug, was better because it was less violent. They have him on, right. There are places where you can find, got to dig deep, but he made comments about marijuana before he became the head of this drug enforcement coalition. I'm sorry, I want to throw that out there again.
Well, it was never about honesty or transparency. It was always about weaponizing cannabis policy and drug policy against Black and Brown communities. And so this is what started in 1937, but there have been subsequent policies like the Controlled Substances Act, which was signed in the 1970s by President Nixon. And it's since been revealed that even President Nixon, in signing the Controlled Substances Act, was really just trying to target Blacks and hippies who were against the war. And so we have
a long
history.
I didn't want to cut you off, but that's something that I think people need to recognize also, is that when that was signed, at the exact same time, we had organizations within the United States government that were trying to figure out how to make sure that more and more illicit substances were shipped into the dark community so that they could continue to arrest more and more. You know, I've used the term, and maybe this is something that you'll find interesting, but I keep using the term, and I don't hear anybody else saying it, but it was a re-enslavement tool. You know, you lost the Civil War, couldn't figure out, Jim Crow couldn't do enough to put us in jail. We couldn't bomb enough black communities. So I know what to do. Let's just start shoving drugs in there. And then the more drugs that we can put in there, we'll make sure we arrest more and more people. Through Nixon, all through Reagan. I mean, we take a look at what happened in the creation of crack, and the proliferation of crack in the black communities. That was something that was driven by a government, not just by the population.
Absolutely. And even through Reagan to the Clinton administration with the 1994 crime bill that was signed by our current President Biden. Right. So there's this long history of anti-drug policies. But as you mentioned, in the larger scheme of things, about half of all drug arrests had been for marijuana, and about 80% of marijuana arrests have been for possession. And when we look at the statistics, we know that Black, Brown, and white folks use cannabis, even sell cannabis at similar rates. But Black and Brown folks are disproportionately impacted across the country, 3.4 times more likely to be arrested. But not only more likely to be arrested, more likely to be sentenced, more likely to be prosecuted, to serve longer sentences, to have to deal with collateral consequences and barriers. So learning all of that was really eye-opening for me. And I thought, if I could just get other folks to understand how impactful cannabis policy was, then maybe we could, you know, collectively organize around it. But I'm coming to learn that there was some naivete and that original opinion, in part because it takes more than folks just, you know, knowing about these harms. We really have to address them at every single level.
Yeah, and you know, when you say it takes more than just knowing about it, but it's almost as if this our community, the cannabis community, hasn't done enough. It's almost that, you know, it's the embarrassment of knowing your history, and you don't want that history to get out there because somehow it may wind up on your shoulders, that we don't really tell the true story. I mean, you know, you look back and you'll see some of these documentaries that have been made, and they completely leave out the entire race issues as if that wasn't really truly an issue. And it is an issue. We know it's an issue. And those who get to tell a story aren't of color. So therefore, the story gets to be whitewashed the way everything else gets to be whitewashed in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a real erasure that's happening across the country when we're having these cannabis legalization conversations. Right. There's often these like performative efforts to help folks participate in the industry. But I think that by and large, there's still so much work to be done. And I think that we're not acknowledging that history. Even at the federal government, we're struggling to acknowledge this history. On the first day of Black History Month this year, the DEA posted a post on Twitter or X where they celebrated President Nixon. On the first day of Black History Month, they posted celebrating President Nixon. It's like, how tone deaf can you be to not understand the history?
Because they want that history to continue and continue and continue. I'm so glad that you're able to at least give some information about this, because I want my listeners to really understand at some point in time, maybe, I don't know, in the next 100 years, I think we will look back at something that, and because I do think within the next 100 years, the entire attitude about hemp will change. And I think it's going to change because we're going to finally recognize not only its medicinal benefits when it is at a level of what's considered cannabis, but we're also going to recognize the fact that just like the peanut and the fact that, you know, way, way, way back in time, you know, we recognize that, you know, there were the peanut was used for a myriad of different things. The hemp plant has probably 2,500 to 3,000 different usages. And we are just now scratching the surface again, recognizing how powerful it was. People don't even know that in this country, back in the late 1600s, early 1700s, you could pay your taxes with hemp. All of our forefathers grew hemp. Every sail, every rope, every ship that was manned by U.S. sailors, every ship that was manned around the world had hemp fiber sails, because we knew that hemp did not deteriorate in salt water the same way when you treat it with just a little bit of oil. So, and then move forward over the course of the next 200 years, you know, science recognized that the hemp seed was probably the most protein-laden seed on the planet, or one of them. So the majority of us ate hemp, and we didn't even recognize that a lot of porridges that we were eating as late as the late 1800s, early 1900s, were porridges made of hemp seed. And hemp seed contains no active cannabinoids other than CBG, and very, very minute levels. And it's not until the plant grows to about 6 weeks old does it start developing those cannabinoids that are of use and that we can find some use of today. So, you know, it's just so crazy to me that even our industry won't tell the truth. And the industry should start telling the truth and maybe find out that there'd be more and more people that would gravitate to recognizing how powerful this industry could be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are some good actors in the space who are, you know, trying to make sure that both government is acknowledging the history of hemp and cannabis and all of its utilizations. But I think that, you know, part of what's necessary is we need our government leaders to act. We're in a situation where we have 24 states who have passed laws legalizing cannabis for adults 21 and older, about 38 states who have medical laws of this program, but all
and the District of Columbia.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said, and the District of Columbia, don't leave it
right,
out.
And the District of Columbia. And all of those laws violate federal policy, because at the federal level, cannabis is still scheduled under the same law that President Nixon signed back in 1970. So,
which was as capricious and arbitrary as it could possibly be, especially with them trying to identify anything with over 0.3%, 0.3% THC is illegal, and anything under 0.3. No, nobody knows where that 0.03 came from. It was just a number that was just picked as if it was, you know, some flashing light, and it really never was. You recently contributed to an illuminating congressional report regarding the changing of marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, and something that seems positive on the surface, but according to that report, which still maintain federal criminalization and its harms. Can you elaborate on this a little bit? And also, one other point I want to make sure people understand is that even though we do have 38 states and the District of Columbia that have passed some form of marijuana law, 24 of them being adult use, in those same states, there are people that are still being arrested for cannabis use.
Absolutely. It's a complicated situation, but basically at the federal level right now, President Biden initiated a review of how marijuana is classified under federal law, the Controlled Substances Act, that same law that President Nixon signed. And it's assumed that the DEA is going to propose that marijuana be moved from Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive schedule, to Schedule 3, a less restrictive schedule.
Can you add the fact that in the last, 3 weeks, the FDA, Health and Human Services, both wrote letters to the DEA asking for it to be rescheduled. And in addition, did not President Biden last week through executive order, I don't know if he actually expunged. I couldn't understand what that rule was that he put forth, but I guess he exonerated those who had been arrested for cannabis violations on federal property if it was not involved with trafficking. Was that right? Did I get that right?
So what President Biden has done thus far, and he's done this twice, is he's issued pardons for simple marijuana possession and simple marijuana use. And this is different than expungements, because a presidential pardon essentially forgives. It essentially is a piece of paper that someone can take around and say that I've been forgiven by the government for this particular offense, whereas an expungement would actually erase that offense from the record entirely. Now, during the 2020 presidential election campaign, President Biden promised to decriminalize cannabis use and expunge cannabis records, but he hasn't done either of those things yet. As I mentioned, he's issued pardons, not expungements. And then with this rescheduling conversation, the scheduling conversation that's happening at the federal level, you had mentioned that the Department of Health and Human Services had recently made an announcement. Essentially, their analysis has become public at this point. So we're able to see the underlying scientific and medical evaluation that is supporting HHS's recommendation to move marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. But ultimately, it's going to be the DEA that is responsible for this decision. And my concern is that it's the same DEA that was celebrating President Nixon on the first day of Black History Month. And if they move marijuana to Schedule 3, it's still going to allow for the criminalization of cannabis at the federal level. This move to Schedule 3 would essentially mean that the government has decided that marijuana has currently accepted medical use, which is a very specific legal term, but it's not going to necessarily legalize medical marijuana at the federal level. And part of the reason why that is because in order for pharmaceutical drugs to be available to the public, they have to go through the FDA approval process. And marijuana is not a product that has gone through the FDA approval process. If a pharmaceutical company decided to take a marijuana drug through the FDA approval process and was successful, that particular drug, after a rescheduling decision, could be legal for use if it were prescribed for a particular condition. But I think that that's part of the misinformation that's kind of happening around this rescheduling conversation, is that there are some folks who assume or are thinking that it's going to legalize these new forms of marijuana. And that's not necessarily so. There's the scheduling process, and then there's the FDA approval process.
But it would still leave us in the exact same position that we are in right now, right? I mean, you've got 24 states and the District of Columbia that have said, 38 states and the District of Columbia that have said, we are going to effectually control cannabis within our state, and feds stay away. And the Cole memo said the Fed will stay away. So even if they reschedule, the feds will still stay away from those 38 states or not.
So not necessarily so. So we had the Cole memo that came out under the Obama administration. But during the Trump administration, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded the Cole memo. And so there's not been a replacement memo from the Department of Justice providing any type of guidance to attorney generals on whether or not to prosecute cannabis-related activity. So it's anticipated, it's always been anticipated that the Biden administration would put out some type of guidance from the Department of Justice. And we're hoping that they can do so in a way that considers the harms that past enforcement practices have caused, but we haven't seen that to date. And so we're still in this situation where state law is going to be in direct conflict with federal law until we deschedule cannabis, remove it from the Controlled Substances Act. And again, either Congress can do this or the DEA can do this. So if the DEA doesn't accomplish this in its current process that the Biden administration has started. Congress can still get this done. The reality is that even if the DEA descheduled cannabis on its own, we're still going to need Congress to act to do things like pass laws for expungement, because, you know, descheduling cannabis, removing it from the Controlled Substances Act in and of itself doesn't create any type of retroactive policy that goes back and says, if you have past cannabis records, we're going to try and address them. And so this is something that Congress is going to have to act on regardless.
And I mean, is there enough of a movement still in this country to try to convince congressmen and Congress, our Congress and our Senate, to pass a bill like this? I mean, I think, you know, we have so many for-profit prisons that are going to go bankrupt because they don't have the ability to continue to arrest as many people as they have in the past. And some of those beds are going to go unfilled. You also recently contributed to the cannabis policy conversation through your work with the DPA, the Ohio State University, and other organizations. How do you see your role in shaping future cannabis regulations, or people like yourself trying to help them shape this? And are they listening?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a concerted effort, particularly over the course of the last 10 years, since the first states have passed adult use cannabis policy, to try, for particularly folks like me, former regulators, folks who are in this doing criminal justice work, who are in this as a part of a larger decriminalization movement. We've been trying to share challenges, best practices, lessons learned, all with an effort to acknowledge that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on the state level, but states are only going to be able to go so far in their reform efforts while cannabis is still illegal at the federal level. And so part of what we've been trying to do is to try and put pressure both on the Biden administration and on Congress to take action on cannabis policy reform. But what I've seen over the course of the last year is that there is this kind of disjointedness with the cannabis industry space. And I think that part of the reason why the industry hasn't been as successful as they probably like to be with federal cannabis policy reform is that I think that the issues that they're prioritizing don't impact everyday people. So for example, in like the last legislative session in Congress, the top priority of many folks in the cannabis industry has been to pass the Safe Banking Act, which would provide protections for financial institutions that are providing financial services to the cannabis industry. Everyday Americans don't care about the Safe Banking Act and protections for financial institutions.
Because it's just a way for rich people to hide to take care of the money, right?
But everyday folks, nobody's ever heard about the war on financial institutions or the war on banks. This is about the war on people and impacts that it's had on people. The fact that people are in cages for this plant, the fact that people are being discriminated against in housing, education, employment, the fact that people are losing custody of their children, that families are being separated, that communities have been disrupted. If we could get the movement to focus back on people as opposed to profits, I think we would see a lot of movement in terms of the politics on this. But I think that the politicians themselves don't necessarily see this as a priority. And they're not necessarily going to see it as a priority, one, unless they're seeing a profit out of this, or two, unless the people are raising this as an issue. And there are enough people around the United States who have been impacted, who continue to be impacted by this policy, that if we coordinate together and send a unified message and say that marijuana must be descheduled, it must be decriminalized, we should be advancing a comprehensive strategy at the federal level that doesn't celebrate Nixon, but acknowledges that harm and addresses that harm, we'd be in a much better position.
But, you know, and I think we would be in a much better position. But unfortunately, as I look at this industry, you know, every day across the industry, from Florida, Georgia, to Massachusetts to Maryland to you name it. I'm going to tell you that as we've seen what's happened, every single one of the municipalities that passes a law, immediately those people who are of color are disenfranchised, you know, and now we've got all these multi-state operators that have come in. And if I take a look, I bet if you take a look from the top to the bottom of a lot of these multi-state operators, yeah, they may have some names of people of color on their books, but those people of color are not working in that office. You know, they may receive a, you know, a very small mailbox check, but they're not necessarily helping to strategize what's going to happen next.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I think that some of these early efforts around equity programs need to be reevaluated and immediately improved. I don't think that these are efforts that should be abandoned, right? We didn't, you know, take a couple years of strategy around anti-drug war policies or drug war policies and say, we're going to walk away from them. If we want to launch an effort and we want it to be successful, I think we need to have these constant evaluations and say, what are these policies that are allowing it to be the case that small businesses, Black and brown businesses aren't successful, but these large multi-state operators are? And I can point to what I've found often is like the single, handed reason why we see inequity in the adult use market. It's in part because there was inequity in the medical market, and the regulatory programs often either prioritize or immediately license everybody that's a medical operator. So there in of itself is one way that many of these jurisdictions are replicating the same inequities that exist in the medical programs and just copying and pasting that same ownership structure into the adult use programs. I think that there are ways by issuing licensing caps on the number of licenses that owners can have, having anti-monopoly provisions. The Parabola Center that I advise is a lot of great work in this regard, trying to promote anti-monopoly provisions and small business provisions. These are not things that are impossible to do, but they require leadership and they require constant attention. And if we don't have folks in government and folks outside of government who care about these issues or who are willing to do the work on these issues, then we're not going to see it because there's not an inevitability here.
I attend a lot of these conferences. I have attended a lot of the conferences, and I don't ever hear conversations like this taking place. Yeah, I might hear something about a brand new extraction system. I might hear, four or five sessions in a row about what we need to have legal banking. But I never hear anybody discussing the inequity at the grassroots level.
Well, I'm going to start inviting you, Montel, to the conversations and tables that I'm a part of, because my colleagues, the organizations that I work with, we're talking about it all the time. We're trying to, build a movement to decriminalize cannabis, to acknowledge these harms. We can't do it alone. I'm working with a larger coalition called United for Marijuana Decriminalization. You find more information at decriminalizemarijuana.com. We're trying to lead this effort to push the Biden administration to keep their promises on cannabis policy reform. But I work with law enforcement, public health officials, industry operators, formerly incarcerated individuals, patients. We need a broad coalition of folks working towards the same thing. And while I recognize that there are different positions on many of the different issues that compromise cannabis policy, I think that there's so much more that we agree on and that we disagree on. And if we can even just get started on working on those things, we can make a lot of progress. But we're going to have to put pressure on our leaders immediately.
Without a doubt. And as a first person of color to lead a medical and adult use cannabis regulatory program, how do you approach the intersection of race and cannabis policy? I mean, I've been a lot of some of these conferences where it's almost, again, I sit in the room and, there aren't that many people of the same color sitting in a room looking back at me. And, it's not an uncomfortable thing for me to bring it up, but it's definitely uncomfortable for the people in the room to hear it. So how do you bridge that gap? How do you start to make people understand that we're not taking shots at anybody? Nobody's being castigated. Nobody's being, you know, particularly, you know, denigrated for not being as open to having these conversations, but we have to have the conversations. And it's almost like the people who've been put on the forums don't even want to have that conversation.
Yeah, I try to be as diplomatic as I can be. And that's been an acquired skill after working in government for a couple of years. But I think that it has to be addressed just directly. The fact that racism was the foundation of cannabis criminalization in the U.S., I think that anti-racism has to be the foundation of future cannabis policy. There has to be some type of balance here. I think that it helps when there are other folks in the room who are have similar values and are working towards the same goals. And so even though I was the first person of color to serve as a regulator responsible for medical and adult use programs, I made an effort with folks who came behind me to start the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition.
I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so a group of colleagues of mine and I started an organization comprised of people of color in the United States who are regulators, either at the state level or at the local level. And this was largely an effort to make sure that we could support each other in our roles, because on one hand, it's a huge task to be responsible for standing up, you know, an entire new industry, to be responsible for the body of work that is cannabis policy reform. And as Black people, as people of color, there's this additional responsibility that many of us feel to our communities, you know, wanting to make sure that we're serving them and that we're being representative of the voices of our communities. And so we do a lot of work trying to make sure that folks don't have to start from scratch when they're starting adult use cannabis programs. We share things like policy best practices and have really just tried to be a resource to not only other regulators, but government officials who are struggling with trying to figure this out. It can be difficult, but again, it's not impossible. And there are now a coalition of folks who are dedicated to doing this work intentionally and with the intention of advancing equity. And so that's how you go from, you know, one to many.
Gotcha. And what are some of the specific legislative changes that you would prioritize to advance this cause?
So some of the specific pieces that we've been advancing, for example, one of the things that I've been working on most diligently this year is this descheduling conversation, is making sure that folks understand the nuances between descheduling, rescheduling, trying to, again, if we don't pass, if we're unable to get descheduling through an administrative effort, working with Congress to pass things like the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act, or the MORE Act. Both of these pieces of legislation would deschedule cannabis at the federal level. They also include policies and provisions that would create expungement of records and dedicate revenue back into communities that have been harmed. But there are so many different issues, whether it's, you know, just trying to figure out the interplay between states' law and federal law, what to do about veterans access, patients access, the international treaties. There are all of these different, you know, cannabis policy has these, all these tentacles that touch all of these different other areas of law. And so part of my role in this effort has really been to make sure that wherever cannabis policy touches, we're looking at it from a lens of who's most impacted, who's disproportionately impacted, and how can we ensure that this advances benefits for all communities, not just businesses, not just folks who have resources.
You know, when you talk about, you know, a lot of people in our country or here in America aren't aware of the fact that there has been almost a constant movement internationally with countries pulling out of what was the 1962-63 treaty that banned, you know, importation and exportation of hemp products. Now you know, around the world, there's 100 or maybe close to 200 countries that have now pulled out. Everybody from South Africa to, you know, three countries in Africa, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru. The list goes on and on. Isle of Man, Spain. There's several countries have now really changed their entire outlook on cannabis. Do you think that's going to have more impact on us here, or is it just going to continue the same flow of inequitable laws that allow certain companies to do certain things and others not to?
Yeah, I think, and it's interesting. I really appreciate that with the new position I've had an opportunity to do some work at the international level over the course of the last year, and have made lots of contacts, have colleagues now who are all across the globe, kind of tracking cannabis policy. And what I've heard from different stakeholders who are following U.S. cannabis policy is that it seems like more so than it is the case that foreign policy is going to impact U.S. policy, it's more likely that U.S. policy is going to impact foreign policy. And this seems a little bit backwards, in part because, as you mentioned, there are so many of these other countries who have gotten so much further than the United States, whether it be in federal decriminalization or federal legalization of medical marijuana. Like, we don't even have that. There are lots of countries that at the very least have decriminalized cannabis or have some form of federal medical marijuana. We're not even there yet. And of course, there are a handful plus more countries that have adult use cannabis, like, for example, Malta and Canada. But what I've heard from these folks is that, you know, the United States was a large driver of placing cannabis in international control through the treaties and the actual establishment of the treaties. And so folks are paying attention to how the U.S. treats its own treaty obligations, because there are many communities outside of the U.S. who have also been harmed by U.S. cannabis prohibition, and feel as though there is an obligation for the U.S. Not only to its citizens, but to other countries, whether it's to try and lead the global descheduling, the descheduling of cannabis at the international level, or at least acknowledging the U.S.'s role in causing harm through international drug policy. But all of these conversations, I think, are going to be ongoing and really picking up over the course of the next several months as this scheduling conversation here in the U.S. continues.
And do you think it'll happen over the next couple of months? Because, you know, I listened to and remember, both the president and vice president making claims that within their first 100 days of office, they were going to do something. And of course, that came and went. And now we're looking at their last couple 100 days. And, you know, I have been one of those saying that, you know, I think if push comes to shove, one or the other is going to step up and recognize that there's a huge voting block that will be supportive of someone who supports cannabis regulations, more favorable cannabis regulations. So one of them is going to step up to the plate and either make a claim again in their campaign speeches that they're going to do something to try to see if they can get this vote. Do you see anything happening between now and the end of this particular administration's reign?
Yeah, I mean, we're still several months out from November, but I do think that this is going to be a part of at least the Biden administration's, at the Biden campaign's effort, particularly to try and target Black, Latino, and youth voters. Anytime they're talking about cannabis and doing like deliberate targeted speeches, they're often talking specifically to those segments of the population, because they think that this is very popular with those particular constituents. The issue for the Biden administration is that, you know, what the people support is decriminalization and legalization. And the only thing that the Biden administration has delivered thus far, let's just say it's been short of those promises. And so even with its administration considering to reschedule cannabis, that's still short of those promises. And so I'd hope that the Biden administration is at least prepared to pivot if this Schedule 3 decision comes down to say, you know, we tried the best we could with our administration, with our DEA, but we're limited in the administrative process, et cetera. We call on Congress to do X, Y, and Z, or, you know, we're going to put together a commission to reevaluate cannabis, to, you know, put out a new memo from our Department of Justice that addresses enforcement disparities. There have to be additional actions taken by this administration, I think, to really get Black, Latino, and youth voters to feel as though they took action on their behalf. Because I know that the Biden administration, when President Biden was asked a couple of years ago what he'd done for the Black community, he responded and said, marijuana pardons. But part of the challenge with that response is that he didn't do that specifically for the Black community, one, and two, that's also not what he promised the Black community.
And but it's also ignorant when the fact that, you know, I remember looking at the television and aghast at what was happening on January 6th and a couple of years ago, and remember several congressmen and other people saying that, you know, those who stormed the Capitol, there was nothing but an acrid smell of marijuana throughout the halls. And if I remember correctly, when I looked at those who stormed the Capitol, they weren't necessarily a lot of people of color in those groups. There were a couple, but there weren't that many. I think probably less than 1%. And so, you know, changes in the cannabis law are not just things that are going to affect people of color. I mean, you go to states like Kentucky, you know, a state where, you know, the Speaker of the House, the Senate, I'm sorry, you know, McConnell's, you know, constituency was one of the biggest growers of cannabis. You know, there's something down there called the Cornbread Mafia that existed in the early 60s and late 50s, early 60s, where, you know, a lot of people think that California is where the majority of cannabis came from or came across the border from Mexico. No. It was grown right down there in places like Kentucky and northern Tennessee.
This is a bipartisan issue. It's highly politicized, and the politics are often racialized. But the reality is that both Democrats and Republicans, and maybe not necessarily their elected officials, but Americans support decriminalization and legalization.
I think the last poll I saw was like up to 92% of people right now think that we should have a federal medical cannabis law in place so that people who need that as a medication can get it. And for the first time in months, first time in years, I think we've seen now that the numbers are plus or higher of 70% plus in polls discussing, you know, making adult use cannabis legal. So I just don't get who's not listening to the same polls that they claim are so important when it comes to other issues.
Yeah, even my my home state of Ohio just became the 24th state to pass adult use cannabis laws, and that's a red state. So if Ohio can pass adult use cannabis, and not only did they pass adult use cannabis, but they passed adult use cannabis that had equity provisions. They passed adult use cannabis policies that gave licensing preferences for folks who were, you know, impacted by cannabis criminalization.
So, but also, I guess, but your state also left on the books giving individual municipalities the right to pull out and not be a part of that. So therefore, you can buy something on one street corner, go three blocks down the road, and get arrested by a cop, thrown in jail for the same thing that's legal three blocks away.
So right now, the law in Ohio is that people would be able to possess, consume anywhere. There are laws that say that local jurisdictions can prevent businesses from operating in their jurisdiction. Be on the lookout, though, because Ohio is wild. And so there are already policies being proposed by lawmakers that would allow local jurisdictions to ban use and possession. But that's not what the law says currently. Ohio is still going to be very, very active in terms of what their adult use implementation actually looks like. But this is an area where in Ohio, the voters passed adult use legalization. The GOP-controlled legislature opposed legalization, And a couple of weeks after the initiative passed, they tried to introduce proposals that would overturn the will of Ohio voters to do things like take money away from social equity programs and divert them to law enforcement, to eliminate, to increase criminal penalties, to eliminate legal protections. But issue two passed with certain provisions, and the Ohio lawmakers right now are going back and forth on different proposals to rewrite it. I've been referring to the Ohio GOP's efforts in Ohio as the Puff Puff Police effort, because they're literally trying to utilize cannabis policy reform as a means to recriminalize cannabis activity.
So makes so sense, but I mean, since you just brought it up, I mean, you looked at some of that. Of course, you looked at all the states that have some sort of legal cannabis. Have you figured out the ones that have gotten some of this right and who's gotten wrong, and maybe learned a little bit about how we can improve some of these laws?
Yeah, I think that jurisdictions, and it's not necessarily about naming a specific jurisdiction, but I think that jurisdictions that don't automatically prioritize their medical operators for adult use cannabis, I think that jurisdictions that place limits on the number of licenses that any individual owner can have, jurisdictions that prioritize programming funding for equity applicants that provide automatic expungement of records that are dedicating resources back to communities most impacted. And like no jurisdiction is getting a perfect score when evaluating all of these different markers. But I think that it's worthy of a consideration to look at all of these issues separately, because it's all of these different things that are constituting whether or not an individual program is successful or not. But what I would consider to be a failure are these different efforts in jurisdictions where we're actually not progressing but regressing and seeing policies that further harm communities. Just to give you another example, Montel, of some of what's been proposed in Ohio. Ohio lawmakers proposed to make it illegal to share cannabis. So literally if I were to pass you a joint or give you a plant, that would be considered illegal trafficking if Ohio lawmakers get their way. So there's ways to do good with cannabis policy reform. But there's also ways to do bad. And that kind of gets back at the earlier point I was raising about, how I might have been naive and originally getting into this work. It does take additional action, not just to acknowledge the harm, but to address it, to make sure that we're not regressing.
But I mean, these same municipalities that are coming up with these, right now, the state of Ohio is collecting an inordinate amount of tax revenue from this program, are they not?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't started their adult use program yet. Adult use sales haven't begun yet. There is revenue associated with their medical program, but even not using Ohio as an example, these jurisdictions are collecting hundreds of millions of dollars annually in cannabis tax revenue. And it's important for government to be very transparent and accountable about where those dollars are being spent. And that's in every single jurisdiction. We need that type of transparency so that we can see when it's going to the cops versus going back into things like treatment or youth or education. That's important for voters to be able to see.
When you look at, in some states like Ohio, I mean, how could a person who's already been adversely affected by past cannabis laws, how can they, start to try to figure out how they can, reenter society? Again, expungement is going to be one thing, but, now I live in a state that hasn't put an expungement clause in, but now I have legal cannabis. It just is an oxymoron. Something's weird here.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that many of these programs aren't created with formerly incarcerated persons in mind. I think that there's a real effort now, particularly as folks are kind of looking at whether or not and how these programs are being successful. And one, identifying that a lot of emphasis has been put around trying to ensure that folks can participate in the industry. And that's important. But I think that that's overshadowed some of these other initiatives that are equally important, because the reality is that there's only so many opportunities to participate in the industry. Only so many people, you know, everybody that's been impacted doesn't want to participate in the industry. What we need to have is a larger effort and program so that regardless of, you know, if you've been impacted, regardless of whether or not you want to participate in the industry, there's some means to connect you to economic opportunity and benefit through government programming. And I think, again, not impossible to do, but it's going to require a larger coordinated effort and an effort that actually focuses on folks who are either formerly incarcerated or have these cannabis arrests or convictions. And there are resources, again, with all of the cannabis tax revenue to get it done. I think that there are resources to be able to support this type of work. But to be frank, this is not the centerpiece of many different cannabis programs across the country.
Gotcha. Now, let me ask you, I'll give you one last question, and I'll let you go. You know, whose responsibility, like, you know, we've had a conversation today that I will tell you, 90% of the people, I think, in the industry, I spend a lot of time with different people in the industry, and I don't have these conversations with them unless they come on my podcast and I can, you know, kind of hold them to fire. Whose responsibility is it to educate us at all on not only what cannabis is? I mean, you know, you attended university and had classes on legalization, but, you know, half the universities in the country aren't even teaching the endocannabinoid system. You know, doctors aren't learning about the viability of this as an agent, even though the FDA just came out 3 weeks ago and said, yes, in fact, there is medical efficaciousness. Whose responsibility is it to educate the masses? Is it the government's responsibility? Is it our industry's responsibility? Whose responsibility is it?
Yeah, it's an important question. And I think it's a shared responsibility. I think that the government definitely has a responsibility to, one, educate themselves, make sure that they're making decisions that are evidence-based, that are fact-based, and that are providing that information, both, you know, what are the health implications, what are the legal implications, but then industry has a responsibility, and then individual, you know, consumers have responsibility as well. So I think that there's a shared responsibility, but I do think that it starts with government. And government has to do a better job of making sure that they're educated so that they can be in a position to educate. And we're constantly learning. The things that I learned in class several years ago, I'm continuing to explore and learn new things every single day. So it's an ongoing process, and government has to join that effort.
Absolutely. Well, look, Kat Parker, I cannot thank you. Packer, I'm sorry. Kat Parker, I can't thank you enough for being a part of Let's Be Blunt with Montel today. Thank you. Wish you well. If you ever want to come back, I'd love to continue to chop it up with you. There's so much more we have to talk about. I mean, we're just barely scratching the surface, but I'd love to get you back for another hour. So we'll reach out if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for being a part of the show today. And for all of you, you know, the key is education. Continue to educate yourself. Find out as much as you can about what you can do in your own community to help advocate for responsible cannabis regulations. And, you know, you may not agree with me, but I'm going to tell you that descheduling is the way to go, not rescheduling. So any efforts that you can do. And Kat, is there someplace they can reach out to, a website or something they can go to if they want to get more information from you?
Absolutely. You can go to drugpolicy.org, decriminalizemarijuana.com, or deschedulemarijuana.com.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. And make sure you reach out to one of those websites and see if you can be involved. I want to thank you all for being a part of Let's Be Blunt with Montel. Make sure you reach the next one. And of course, before you do, go down there and tap that little subscribe button. You'll find out a lot more information that you never knew existed right here on Let's Be Blunt with Montel. Thanks so much for being a part of the show today. Be well. Peace. Thanks for joining me on our Three Thinking with Montel. Please make sure you're subscribed and hit the bell to be notified when new episodes post each week. We'd love to hear feedback, so please send us your comments.
Thanks for listening to today's show. to check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Larry Mishkin, and I'd like to invite you to join Rob Hunt and me on our weekly podcast, The Deadhead Cannabis Show. Each week, we explore the latest cannabis and jam band news and reminisce with other deadheads and jam band lovers about the great musical acts that we've seen and heard. Check out a new episode every Monday.